When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, you can invest in what's trending in artificial intelligence, big data, robotic revolution, and more. It's an easy way to invest in ideas you believe in. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Hello, and welcome to Decoder. I am not Nilay Patel, though this is his show about big ideas and other problems. My name is David Pierce, and I am the editor-at-large at The Verge and the co-host of The Vergecast. I'm subbing in for Nilay today, who is out on vacation, I think in Mexico somewhere. Regular Decoder programming will be back next week. But in the meantime, we have an exciting episode for you today, and it's all about software emulation. In particular, we're talking about the emulation of video games, which, as it turns out, is a whole lot more complicated than it seems. Emulation in general is an old and well-established concept in computing. It's part of the way that Apple was able to reverse engineer Microsoft's Office file formats decades ago in order to make them work inside of Apple's own workplace apps like Pages and Keynote. It's also how computer makers, decades ago, figured out how to make software that worked across platforms. In the gaming world, too, emulation has been around for decades. But it made headlines recently because one of the most widely used programs for emulating the Nintendo Switch, a platform called Yuzu, was effectively sued out of existence thanks to a devastating legal complaint from, you guessed it, Nintendo. In one sense, it was a classic copyright infringement complaint from a company known for aggressively protecting its intellectual property. But Nintendo accused the anonymous creators of Yuzu, a mysterious entity known as Tropic Haze LLC, of, quote, facilitating piracy at a colossal scale. Within just a few days, the group settled with Nintendo for millions of dollars, and Yuzu folded completely. There's a whole lot going on here, from the history of game emulation to the copyright precedents of emulators to the way that the threat of game piracy still looms large in the industry. To break down this topic, I brought on Verge senior editor and resident emulation expert Sean Hollister. Sean and I get into what emulators actually are and how they work. We break down why the idea of playing a video game on hardware it wasn't designed for has been a lifelong mission for enthusiasts, and why that might as well be the end of the world for companies like Nintendo and Sony. You'll hear Sean explain why Yuzu was such a big deal and why it broke a kind of unwritten rule in the game industry around emulating modern-day hardware to play newly released, or in some cases even unreleased, video games. We also talk about the DMCA. Yes, that's right, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Because this is Decoder, after all, and Nilay's not here, but we have to do it for him anyway. The DMCA actually plays a huge role in this story, and you'll be fascinated to learn that it does, in fact, protect some video game emulation, even though it's also the law that console makers have used since the 90s to go after the emulation community. Consumers and companies have been waging this battle over what they can and can't do with the hardware and software they buy since the beginning of the tech industry. And video games are a big part of that story. But this recent fight about Yuzu feels new, and it has the potential to change the emulation industry for years to come. Okay, Yuzu and the state of video game emulation. Here we go. Sean Hollister, welcome to Decoder.
Thanks for having me.
It's so fun to get to do this with you. This is very exciting. We're here to talk about emulators, which is kind of a big, messy, complicated space. But let's just maybe define a few terms here at the beginning just to set up what we're talking about. What is a game emulator? Just at the broadest possible level.
At the broadest possible level. It's a piece of software that allows you to run a game, an app, a program, as if you were on another piece of hardware. So you're on a PC, and you want your PC to play games like it's a Nintendo Switch, or a Super Nintendo, or a PlayStation, or any of these game consoles. Or maybe you're on a MacBook, and you want your MacBook to play a Windows application. You can use emulators or translation layers to tell your computer that it's actually some other piece of hardware.
So by that definition, it seems like emulators, A, have kind of been around forever, and B, are about much more than just video games. Again, at this big level, we're going to talk a lot about games on this episode, but I think it's actually important that emulators are this like foundational technology to how computers work in a lot of ways, right?
Absolutely. Emulators fundamentally underpin a lot of what we do day to day. But in the video game space, which we're talking about a bunch today, it's been an argument for a very long time that you should be able to develop a brand new program for your Super Nintendo or your PlayStation that can run on a computer for purposes of figuring out how software works and preserving software and just learning how these systems are built. And so a lot of emulation folks are like, this is an important right that we need to maintain, even if at the end of the day, what a lot of people do is they just pirate Nintendo Switch games and play them.
In the gaming space specifically, I've only really come around to the emulation community recently as retro gaming and kind of all of the like nostalgia of the early NES and N64 games have come back. And I confess I have had moments where I have wanted to play N64 games on non-N64s and have looked into this space. Has emulation been a part of the video game industry for a long time, or is it really growing now because there is so much nostalgia for that kind of early generation of gaming?
So we're in a bit of a what I would call like an emulation fever pitch right now, because we do have not only so many gamers wanting to play their games on their iPhone, but we also have the companies themselves, the Nintendos, the Sonys of the world, using emulation to allow you to play their older games again on newer consoles. They want to sell you a new copy of Crash Bandicoot and The Legend of Dragoon. And so they use emulation themselves in their Nintendo Switch Online, or some of the games you'll find on the PlayStation Store. And this is a virtuous cycle where not only can you potentially get a little bit of pirate or hacker fame or computer, you know, building fame by building an emulator, you might also get a job in the industry based on what you're learning there.
So that's an emulator. And emulators play ROMs. What is a ROM and where do they come from?
ROM stands for read-only memory, but what it basically is it's an encapsulated file that contains all the parts of the game. If you take a ROM, that is basically the container with the game in it, and you stick that into an emulator and it plays. ROM is a generic way to refer to these games that can be distributed as files.
Where do they come from typically? How does one find a ROM? Purely hypothetically, not that I'm asking.
Purely hypothetically, if you were to do it quote-unquote properly, and when I say properly, I do not know for a fact that this is legal, and it's a question that I want to answer. Properly, you would dump it from your own system. You would have a Nintendo Wii with the homebrew channel on it and a hard drive plugged into the back with a USB cable. You'd stick in your own copy of a disc that you actually own and bought and plan to keep around and aren't going to return to GameStop for a refund. You'd stick it in there. It would pull the ROM or ISO off there, and you'd have it on a hard drive. Then you could stick it into your emulator and shift it that way. Also, purely hypothetically, you could probably find them in various parts of the internet.
So, Sean, very important question. Are emulators legal?
Yes.
Are we sure?
Maybe.
Okay.
Kind of. Possibly.
Cool.
Sorta. The idea of an emulator is absolutely legal. It's gone through the courts. There have been several cases where not only has it been deemed legal by at least an appeals court level to create an emulator, fundamentally a program that is emulating another piece of hardware for purposes of interoperability with other software, yada, yada, jargon. Not only is it legal to do that, it's legal to do that for a profit.
Sean makes a really good point here. You could theoretically sell an emulator for the PlayStation. And some companies like Bleem and Kinectix did just that back in the 90s. There's even a clip of Steve Jobs and Phil Schiller demoing the Kinectix virtual game station on the Mac at an Apple conference in 1999.
At Macworld today, Kinectix is introducing the virtual game station. It is software that they're going to sell for $49 that turns your Mac into a Sony PlayStation. It plays a few hundred of the Sony PlayStation games today. And I'd like to ask Phil to come back and give us a quick demo.
Things didn't really end well for the virtual game station. Sony sued Kinectix, but eventually Kinectix did win on appeal. Emulation enthusiasts actually cite that case as one of the major legal precedents establishing a fair use argument for emulators. But right after that, Kinectix turned around and sold the rights to its software to Sony, which then shut it down after a few months. So it's important to note that emulators like that were and are legal. But as video game hardware became more sophisticated over time, that legality became a little murkier. Here's Sean explaining why.
The question is, what happens when technological protections come into play? What happens when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says, well, maybe you can make an emulator, but in order to actually get any of the pieces you would need to play games on that emulator, you would have to break copyright law.
So it's not building the emulator that's illegal. It's doing what you have to do to get the emulator to talk to the game, potentially.
Where this comes down is encryption, really. Video game consoles and handhelds have gotten increasingly sophisticated over the years, not just in terms of how much they can do, but how much copyright protection the companies try to throw on top of that. With a Super Nintendo, you could dump the cartridge. You could take the files, basically, that are on the cartridge and copy them to a PC. You could do this with a Game Boy Advance, too. It's not just ancient Super Nintendo. Anything that relied on a very simple cartridge, you just copy those files over, you drop those files into the emulator, and they would run. Then we got to BIOSes. Okay, so your Sony PlayStation, your PS2, your PS3, and certain other systems would also have a set of instructions for how they run at a hardware level, but it's made of software, and it's a copyrighted piece of software. Nintendo coded that BIOS. Sony coded that BIOS. You can't run this emulator without a copy of software that you don't have. Unless, like one emulator developer did for the PSP, you don't actually use the BIOS at all. You emulate the BIOS too. You emulate the underlying hardware.
Let's just take a second here to break down what a BIOS is. It stands for Basic Input-Output System. And in simple terms, you can think of it like the instruction manual for a computer. In the context of a video game console, the BIOS is what tells the piece of game hardware how to run a piece of game software. Courts have found that the underlying code there is in fact proprietary and can in fact be copyrighted. But without getting too in the weeds here, there are fair use exceptions where a BIOS can be used as a reference to reverse engineer a custom BIOS of your own, which is what happened in some of the copyright cases that Sony brought against companies like Kinectix that we mentioned earlier. This is a really murky part of the legal debate over emulation and reverse engineering, and as you'll hear Sean explain, a lot of emulator makers just don't want to cross a line that might invite a lawsuit, especially as video game hardware has only gotten more locked down and the software that runs it more complicated and more encrypted over the years.
What many emulators would say for a long time is, we are a, and this is a term I've heard thrown around, I don't know if they said this, we are a bring your own BIOS emulator. Here's the emulator. You can use it. It's not going to do much without a BIOS. Go ahead and dump the BIOS from your own system if you can, or more likely you'll pirate that off the internet.
Right. Implicit in that is, we are going to close our eyes for 10 minutes and then you're going to have a BIOS and we're not going to ask any questions about it.
Exactly. And this was, from what I can gather, completely tolerated by the video game industry. Emulators are legal, BIOS probably not, but can we go after the emulator folks for a BIOS? nah, could we go after the users and pirates? Maybe, but we're not going to bother because that's like trying to enforce, you know, every download of an MP3 back in the day. You're not going to do that.
Yeah, that doesn't go well for anybody. We have to take a quick break. When we get back, Sean and I get into what happened to Yuzu and how it's totally upended the game emulation community. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message is brought to you by E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade, no matter what kind of investor you are. Our tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/Vox. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We're back with Verge senior editor Sean Hollister to talk about what happened to Nintendo Switch emulator Yuzu and what it means for the future of game emulation. So this is all good ground setting, which brings us to today and brings us to Yuzu. Tell me about Yuzu.
So Yuzu was the leading Nintendo Switch emulator. And I can't tell you off the top of my head why it was the leading Nintendo Switch emulator, but there was this moment where not only did we have Nintendo Switch games playable on PCs, but people realized that they could take this one emulator and they create forks of it to play Switch games on their iPhone. They could put Switch games on their Steam Deck. They could put them on these handheld gaming PCs. And not only could they could do that at a higher level of performance, more FPS, higher resolution than they could on the Switch itself. It's been a case for a long, long time that emulation was considered a bit of a brute force way of playing games on modern hardware, that you would need brute force levels of computing from your processor in order to do that. So maybe in 2000, 2002, that time frame, you've got your Nintendo GameCube able to play that graphical level of games. It takes years after that before PC chips can do enough brute force to play those games well. But the Nintendo Switch, those games can play better on a Steam Deck than they do on the Nintendo Switch.
Because the Switch is just like it's a bunch of smartphone chips, right?
It is. And they can do it within its own lifespan. The emulation community, they're saying, hey, you can play this game that Nintendo just released, Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. You can play it on day one, or maybe even before it comes out, if you got a leaked copy of the game or something, on our system, and it's better than it is on Switch. So the question is, why do you buy a Nintendo Switch if you could theoretically get this game and play it on your Steam Deck or on your PC, and it looks better there?
In the course of this, what actually happened to Yuzu?
Yuzu was sued out of existence. Nintendo came at them with an actual legal complaint that alleged that Yuzu was facilitating piracy at a colossal scale, said they broke like five different layers of encryption, and told them they wanted their domain name and all of their assets and social media accounts, and that was it.
Did Yuzu fight this at all?
Not in the least. Yuzu had to pay $2.4 million to Nintendo and agreed not to work on any emulation against Nintendo ever again. We don't know who Tropic Haze LLC, the company behind Yuzu, actually is. It could be one guy in his basement who said, I don't want anybody to know that it's one guy in the basement, and therefore I'm just going to drop the whole project like a stone because I don't want it revealed who I am. It could be that simple. Or it could be a lot of people making a bunch of money off of this thing. We don't really know. statutory damages add up to a lot. And so maybe they settled for $2.4 million and will go away forever because that was easier than however many ridiculous millions it might have been if they'd tried to fight.
How unique a story is that? When I think of emulation, I think of, like you were saying a minute ago, ways to play kind of generations-old games. But it seems like what you just described Yuzu being is going to raise the hackles of basically anyone in the gaming industry paying attention. Is this a new thing that Yuzu managed to do that other emulators had not pulled off in quite the same way? Or has this been happening forever?
So Yuzu is not unique in that it's emulating the Nintendo Switch and allowing you to play it on other systems, but it became the most popular very quickly. It was forked a number of times, ported to other systems. It got everywhere to the point where Nintendo pointed out that when people were downloading copies of pirated games off the web, some of these games would mention that they were designed to be played on Yuzu. These files were, you know, hint, hint, wink, wink, maybe you should play these in your Yuzu emulator.
So Yuzu, from what I can tell, broke this kind of unspoken agreement or detente in the gaming industry where all the emulators were kind of tacitly allowed to exist because they weren't really getting in the way, and they were mostly letting people who continue to buy games play the old games that they had probably bought. And Nintendo and the other companies just kind of agreed to be cool about it because it wasn't really worth pursuing anyway. And Yuzu broke this dam. Why do you think Yuzu was the one that broke this dam and actually riled up Nintendo to the point where it threatened to sue Yuzu completely out of existence?
It's got to be Zelda. I mean, in addition to the ability to play all these Nintendo Switch games on your handhelds, Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom in particular, Nintendo alleged that it was pirated a million times before it came out, and that some of those files, the file names or something, suggested that it was designed to be used with Yuzu, the emulator. And while I don't know that for a fact, that, you know, that it was actually Yuzu that did that, I do know that on day one, people were playing copies of Tears of the Kingdom and Yuzu using guides that had been prepared in advance using those pirated copies of the game.
And if ever you were going to do something that got Nintendo's attention in a big way, doing that on launch day of Tears of the Kingdom is probably the quickest way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think over the years Nintendo has not pursued some of this stuff more aggressively?
I think at the end of the day, it's a crazy balancing act that Nintendo has to do because Nintendo profits from emulation in small ways that add up over time. And they profit from having an active, interested fan community that is so devoted to their intellectual property that they're willing to develop an entire game or spend all of their waking hours pouring their sweat, blood, and tears into an emulator that'll play, you know, Wind Waker 20% better than it did on a GameCube, and maybe at 4K resolution, I don't know. They want to have that devoted fan community. Back in the day, there were periods of time where companies would shut down, you know, kind of any project at the slightest provocation. And that hasn't been the case with Nintendo in recent years. They wait until something has so much critical mass that they can't ignore it anymore. Not only did a bunch of fans spend time making this, I don't know, Portal 64 remake for Nintendo 64 emulators of Valve's, you know, Portal, but they're about to release it or something like that. They're going to make a big splash by doing this thing that is probably illegal right under Nintendo's nose. It's getting a lot of press. It's finally maybe in a place where it will cut into Nintendo's profits, or where Nintendo will have this responsibility to shareholders. Yeah, you got to protect your IP. Otherwise, maybe it's not going to be worth anything at the end of the day. And Yuzu most definitely had that critical mass. People were talking, making YouTube video after YouTube video about how to get your Nintendo games running on the Steam Deck, how to get your Switch games running there. Valve, in a video that they edited after the fact, had Yuzu as one of the little icons in its Steam Deck promo video. Valve did not leave that up for very long.
I guess, to some extent, the case for allowing these emulators to exist is that you let the people who love your products most continue to find ways to engage with them. And the case for taking them down is that you let the people who love your products most continue to engage with them for free, right? Yes. Like, if I'm boiling it all the way down, is that that's kind of the tension, right?
I think that's exactly right. There is another, I don't know how powerful this incentive is to let the emulation community keep going, but Nintendo and Sony and the rest, they do learn something from those developing emulators too. They hire from the emulation community to develop their own in-house emulators that let you play your old, you know, Game Boy Advance games on your Nintendo Switch or play your PlayStation 1 games on your PS5. We know that they hire from those communities and that they learn things about how hardware works. If somebody figures out how to make Switch games run way better than Nintendo can make them run themselves, that's valuable knowledge for those companies to imbibe. And so they do.
The other case that seems like it's important in this context is Dolphin, which was a few years ago. And I think one of the things I'm trying to figure out in this whole process is where this line is for a company like Nintendo to go from allowing these communities to exist on the internet versus causing them huge amounts of trouble. And I feel like Dolphin explored one version of that line. Can you explain what happened there?
Dolphin is the most popular GameCube and Wii emulator. It came out in the early 2000s, and it does both of those Nintendo consoles. The Dolphin case is really interesting for two reasons. One reason is that it did not get served with a legal complaint. It did not get sent a DMCA takedown. This was very much the result of Nintendo Legal being approached with an, is this okay for this emulator to appear on the Steam store? Valve wanted to know if this was kosher. And apparently Valve reached out to Nintendo's legal team. And what do you think Nintendo's legal team is going to say if you come to them and ask, is emulation okay? I think they're probably going to try to shut that down. And so Dolphin wound up not being able to bring Dolphin to Steam, very specifically to Valve's Steam PC game digital distribution platform, because Valve asked Nintendo and Nintendo said, nope. And then Valve said, nope, probably we're not going to bother doing this. At the end of the day, a platform, whether it be Valve with Steam or whether it be GitHub hosting or GitLab, I should say, hosting files for emulators, as it did for a few of the clones of Yuzu after Yuzu got sued out of existence by Nintendo, the platform has no responsibility to keep up anything that they don't want, that they don't want to fight for. The platform, they can, at the slightest provocation, at the slightest hint from Nintendo or any other company that they might have any kind of legal threat coming at any point in the future, they can say, bye, we don't need you. If it's an application that might ever be used for piracy, there's even less incentive for them to defend. There is a whole process. If Valve did want to defend against a DMCA takedown request, there's a whole process. They can say, Dolphin, you can give us a counter notice to the DMCA, you can reveal where your developers live, you can agree that you were served with this notice, and then you can fight it. We'll take that back to Nintendo and say, Nintendo, do you really want to go after us for this? And that allows Valve to be protected from the Nintendo lawsuit, theoretically.
In the Yuzu case, though, this was not about a platform or a partner or something. This was about Yuzu specifically, right?
In both of these cases, there was no DMCA takedown. This was never a DMCA takedown issue. It was a DMCA issue.
We have to take another quick break, and when we get back, Sean and I are going to break down what the DMCA is and why this copyright law is so important in the context of video game emulation.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America. The endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with Verge senior editor Sean Hollister to explain the DMCA and how it's played a central role in the game industry's copyright disputes. So what is the law we're talking about here? You've mentioned the DMCA a few times. Is the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, what we're looking at when we talk about this stuff?
Absolutely. So, Digital Millennium Copyright Act has all kinds of statutes in it. But the two that we talk about most are DMCA 512, which has to do with DMCA takedowns. That's the idea that a platform can protect itself from lawsuits by saying, we didn't upload this thing, we took it down as soon as we saw it because of our notice or whatever.
That's when you go to YouTube and the video is gone. 512.
Yes, 512. But then there's DMCA 1201, and that is about circumvention of technological protection measures. That's the statute that has not been litigated in regards to emulators. There haven't been any cases where we've said, oh yeah, it's okay or it's not okay for somebody to break encryption, break technological protection measures, go around them, sidestep them while trying to play a game. So DMCA 1201 says, and I quote, no person shall manufacture, import, offer to the public, provide, or otherwise traffic in any technology, product, service, device, component, or part thereof. That is, here's the important part, primarily designed or produced for the purpose of circumventing a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. Primarily designed to circumvent technological protection measures.
Right. Actually, while we're reading laws to each other, can I read you the very beginning of 1201, which
yes.
I actually think is sort of fascinating. It just says, no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. And I have had this sentence stuck in my head for a long time because Cory Doctorow, who is an author and activist and was on Decoder a while ago, it was a really good episode. Everybody should listen to it. He described it to me one time as basically saying, it doesn't matter what's on the other side of the lock. The fact that it has a lock means breaking the lock is illegal. And as soon as I put a lock on something, you can't break it. It doesn't matter what's on the other side. And he was deeply enraged by the way that that was set up. But I feel like that goes to what you're talking about, where we've come to the conversation is, it's in some ways not about the games or the emulators. It's about these encryption keys. And it seems like increasingly people want to focus on the locks because we don't have to talk about anything else, because DMCA 1201 says if you break the lock, whatever you did it in service of, it doesn't matter. It's illegal.
Yeah, it is such a powerful and frustrating law for anyone in this space or people at home who just want to fix their own shit. You know, I want to fix my own gadgets, and DMCA 1201 is telling me that if they have software locks on them, I cannot break those locks. When it comes to the locks, there are two things to think about with regards to emulation. One is that every 3 years, the Library of Congress decides that you can pick a few of these locks for a limited amount of time. There are exceptions to the DMCA 1201 that are set by the Copyright Office. Maybe these 3 years, you can work on your John Deere tractor or whatever it is. Maybe these 3 years, we will allow this kind of software to exist in libraries. The other thing, though, to draw your attention to that, primarily designed for the purpose of circumventing encryption, this is the thing that comes up time and again when the emulation community is trying to argue that DMCA 1201 does not apply to them. Yuzu and every other emulator developer wants to say, we are not primarily designed to break encryption.
What do they say they're primarily for?
I don't think they say they're primarily designed for anything. Because they can't say that 99% of people are going to play homebrew games on this or public domain games, particularly for the Nintendo Switch, where there will not be any public domain games. It is a relatively new console from 2017.
I will say I've heard people say things about game preservation and accessibility and that kind of thing. And I find those arguments convincing as far as they go. But again, to your point, many more people just want to play Mario than are worried about the cultural history of video games.
They are. They really are. I wouldn't say that it's a shame, because enough people are, and I think will be, interested in the preservation of video games that eventually we'll get to somewhere where we are preserving them more thoroughly, I hope. I hope we don't lose too many things before that happens along the way. But with Yuzu, Nintendo argued that it was primarily designed to circumvent, that it was primarily designed for piracy. And when Yuzu flipped, it agreed, whoever is at Tropicase LLC, agreed that Yuzu was primarily designed to circumvent these technological protections, and they apologized for the piracy. And that is not a precedent. It's a settlement, so it's not a legal precedent. It's not like every emulator is now crippled by the idea that it's been decided that one of them is primarily designed to circumvent technological protections. But Nintendo got one of them to roll over real easy and say the thing that no other emulator developer would admit.
And it seems like that, Yuzu just taking the hit and agreeing to the settlement, has really spooked the rest of the emulator world.
Absolutely. We don't know how long it'll spook them. There's optimism that this is just a moment where everybody's, you know, we're all going to watch our backs, we're going to be careful. But yes, a bunch of developers just outright quit the scene. They're like, we're done with emulation. This is too hot now. This precedent from Nintendo that we all now know, the emulation community all now knows, gamers all now know, that Nintendo could come down at any moment and you probably wouldn't be able to do much about it, because they have that argument in their back pocket. Who knows if Nintendo would win such a lawsuit if any emulator developer decided to actually fight it, but they can definitely get into court. They can get heard on the back of DMCA 1201, which means that any emulator developer would need to lawyer up, and no emulator developer has the money to lawyer up.
Have we seen this happen in court at all? Is there any legal precedent for how a case like that might go if somebody decided to fight it all the way to the end?
On 1201 with emulators, no. I've been told that there is no precedent where anybody's gone into court with an emulator and fought even a little bit, much less all the way to the end. But we do know that Nintendo has come down with criminal charges on those who sell mod chips, which is another way to get into the Nintendo console. They've come down on ROM sites and mod chip sellers very hard in the past. Gary Bowser, who of course has the same last name as the famous Nintendo character and of Nintendo of America's current president, he was sentenced to 40 months in prison. And I think he only served maybe 14 of them, but it changed his life because he was selling a physical circumvention device to allow people to hack into their Nintendo Switches and possibly play pirated games on them.
It seems like there are two main assumptions people could be making now, right? On the one hand, it might seem like we've entered an era where companies like Nintendo are just simply going to be more aggressive and litigious. On the other, there could be a chance that Yuzu was a target because it very specifically got too big and was leaking games, and then once the dust settles, everything can go back to business as usual otherwise. Is the community feeling one of those more than the other?
I want to say it's kind of neither of those.
Okay.
On the one hand, yes, the threat is absolutely out there. Nintendo could do this at any moment. There's the maybe if we get quieter, Nintendo will go away and let things be the way they were. But there's also this sense that maybe things will never go back to being the way that they were because now every console will have encryption, maybe many layers of it, and that the threat of the DMCA 1201 will now hang over every emulator going forward. Nintendo has not just shown that they can make an emulator developer roll over. They have shown how to make an emulator developer roll over. And the how is you protect your console better, you add more layers of technological protection measures, and then more emulator developers will think twice about doing that.
Do you think that arms race is just going to move the emulator community out more and more? I mean, on the one hand, you've described a pretty real technical arms race that is hard for hobbyists to keep winning. On the other hand, you've described a legal arms race that is really hard for hobbyists to keep winning, especially next to deep-pocketed lawyers at these gaming companies. To some extent, it sounds like maybe the only plausible thing for a lot of people to do is just kind of throw up their hands and give up and find something else to do.
I think that many will think twice about jumping headfirst into emulation, but there's also this undercurrent of fuck Nintendo that also pushed a number of forks of Yuzu to exist. There's this sense that, gosh, Nintendo, we bought these games. We are dumping them from our own Switches using the copies that we bought. They play better in an emulator. If Nintendo isn't going to, you know, at least make these games play their best and give us powerful hardware to run them on, we should have the legal right to do this thing. And people who believe that they have the legal right to do a thing and don't actually have the legal right to do a thing often will use emulation and other technologies as a form of protest. And so I imagine we'll see protesters keep popping up. I don't know.
It seems like there would be an opening there for the gaming companies to, if not extend an olive branch, then at least sort of solve the problem. If you go back to the music piracy example, that got really messy and really ugly and really bad. And then we got music streaming, which was essentially the product people wanted all along. And it worked and in large ways killed the piracy industry. Do you think there's a path there for emulation to go sort of full legit in that way?
I don't think so. I've heard it from a few developers as well. I don't ever see that happening because unlike music, the quality matters so much and it changes so much over time. You know, if you have a master recording of a particular piece of music, that's the best that recording is ever going to be, right? It just gets worse from there as it gets downsampled. But with a game, we all know that if they sit on a game for a long time, they can make it look better. They can remaster the game. They can re-release the game. They can sell it once again to people and make another chunk of money on it, or, you know, have it prop up their subscription service as Nintendo does with Nintendo Switch Online. And if it can use these emulated games to get people paying monthly for Nintendo Switch Online, I don't think it would ever choose to distribute individual ROMs instead, particularly when those could potentially be copied and create another cycle of piracy.
Thanks again to Sean for taking the time to speak with me, and thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it, and don't worry, Neil is back next week. If you have big ideas on what the Decoder team should cover or who they should have on the show, they really do want to hear your feedback. You can email them all at decoder@theverge.com. They really do read every email. Or hit up Neelai directly on Threads. Neelai is at reckless1280. There's also a TikTok. Check it out. At DecoderPod on TikTok. It's a lot of fun. Decoder is a production of The Verge and is part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Kate Cox and Nick Statt and was edited by Callie Wright. Our supervising producer is Liam James. The Decoder music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. See you next time.